So Brooks Richards, reel 9. The light signal was showing perfectly correctly from the beach, and when I landed, the reception party produced the right password, so the little bears were all landed to them, and I returned to Malta. A month later, I had to go back to the same site to carry out a repeat operation, landing an additional radio operator, and this was already at the beginning of May 1943. It was no longer necessary to use Malta as base because Sousse and Sfax had already fallen to the 8th Army. So I drove all the way round the Allied lines, down south as far as Karawan and then to Sousse, where I was given 2 brand new American PT boats to carry out this operation, and we set off, and we were halfway up to Cap Bon with the radio operator when we had a breakdown and one of the boats, and so we had to turn back. And next day we set out again to do the same operation, I repeat, and we got again halfway up when I received a signal recalling me. So I turned around and went back to base, and it emerged that my colleague Hamish Torrance had, with great speed, descended on, had gone into Tunis with the first troops into Tunis, and had gone in person to the jail, the Bardo jail, and had discovered, written on the wall of one of the cells, graffiti which showed that Mallory, to whom I'd supposed I'd been working, had in fact been in jail for more than 2 months. So that the previous month, I had landed to a German-controlled reception party, and they decided to let me go at that stage rather than blow the fact that they had got Mallory and his organization under control. But the second time round, I can't see any reason why they would have been so disposed. I think I would have certainly been at the rest of the war as a prisoner. But by very good fortune, that one mechanical breakdown and the presence of mind of my colleague Hamish prevented me from ever getting to the beach that night. Well, with the end of the Tunisian campaign, I cruised back on Mutin, the Tunnyman that we had had at Helford, and that Holdsworth had sailed out with one of the other fishing boats from Helford a few weeks after I landed in North Africa, and he'd been using her as a base for our naval operations, paranaval operations of a more tactical sort up the coast. We cruised gently back to Algiers, which was very pleasant, and I found then that SOE's mission in North Africa, as distinct from the mission for the Tunisian campaign, which was known by the code name Massingham, was established in a very comfortable complex of villas standing in sand dunes about 20 miles to the west of Algiers. Right, in fact, on one of the beaches where the landings had been carried out on the 8th of November, and across those very same beaches the original French occupation of Algiers in, was it 1830, had been carried out by Maréchal Bugeaud. And this Club des Pins, as it was named, had been requisitioned for use as a training camp by SOE, and it was very suitable for the purpose. And the task that immediately befell the naval section at that stage was operations to Corsica, which was occupied by the Italians still, and Massingham had, in cooperation with Giraud's Deuxième Bureau, had trained and sent into Corsica a very remarkable agent in the shape of a gendarmerie officer, a lieutenant colonel of gendarmerie, quite a senior fellow, named Paul Colonna d'Istria, who was a Corsican. And Colonna d'Istria had gone in before I got back to Algiers, but the story of how his mission had begun was rather fascinated me. He'd apparently, his family came from very south of Corsica, where there's quite a lot of Arab influence in people's attitudes and habits. And he believed profoundly in having his horoscope done every year. And sometime before the Allies landed in North Africa, he'd had his horoscope done for that year, and he'd been told, to his great surprise, that he would undertake a perilous mission to his native land. He couldn't understand this, because at the time, going to Corsica, which was his native land, was no more complicated than going and buying a steamship ticket in Algiers and waking up 24 hours later across in Corsica. But after the Allies landed, he came along and reported, I suppose originally to the Palais d'Été, to Giraud's Deuxième Bureau, to say that he thought he would like to volunteer for a mission to Corsica. And this was welcome news to everybody, and he was appropriately prepared and went in. Of course, he was ideal for the job because he could bicycle around Corsica with gendarme cover very well indeed, and he got a great deal of cooperation out of the gendarmerie. And the resistance, the original Maquis, after all, Maquis is the term applying to the Mediterranean undergrowth of Corsica, and the original concept of the Maquis really arose there in under his direction in the early part of 1943. And I found the naval section at Algiers had the opportunity really to carry out submarine operations with the largely the British submarines initially from HMS Maidstone. Yes, I think it was Maidstone. Could have been the fourth. I think Maidstone, anchored in, moored in Algiers Harbour. And at any rate, operations had already taken place, and I got involved in others. And at that stage, we found that we could get the services of a very big, by Mediterranean standards, French submarine called the Casabianca. Well, the British submarines working in Western Mediterranean of the T and S classes were 600 tons, and the operations that they undertook for us were hedged about with all sorts of restrictions designed to keep them out of trouble. We usually couldn't get them to go within a mile of the shore, for example, which meant a lot of rowing. It was very understandable given the naval priorities of the time. But with the Casabianca, matters were quite different. Casabianca had, in fact, been... Casabianca was about three times as large. She was 1,700 tons. And she had, in fact, been in Toulon in 1940 and had been interned there under the Italian Armistice Commission. But her captain, who was a man named L'Herminier, who by our submariner's standards was ridiculously old to be in charge of such a vessel, because he was 43. He had managed to conceal fuel from the knowledge of the Italian armistice authorities. He belonged, incidentally, to a royalist family who had lived in the West Indies ever since the Revolution. They'd never been willing to move back to France because they were so anti-republic, anti-republican in sentiment, but they'd never thought that sending sons to serve in the Navy, which was frequently nicknamed La Royale in France at the time, involved any compromise of principle. So L'Herminier, following this tradition, had gone into the Navy. And when the Germans arrived at Toulon in the course of the occupation of the south of France, only a few days after we landed in North Africa, because until then there had been the zone non occupe, the whole of the southeast of France, had fallen in that area under direct Vichy authority and minus any occupying troops. When they got down there, most of the French fleet, unable to move, scuttled itself. But L'Herminier cast off his moorings and made a dash for the high seas. And the Germans dive-bombed him on the way out of the harbor, and he had to crash dive, and he left his cap on the bridge in going below very rapidly. So his cap was found, and the Germans' first impression was that they must have sunk the submarine. But, of course, further investigation revealed that there was no wreck underneath that spot at all. He'd slipped out, crossed the Mediterranean, turned up outside the boom in Algiers and on the surface, and had come into the harbour and joined the Allied forces. But given this rather unusual history, there are certain problems of security arose. For example, she got no ASDIC gear, as we understood it, and her torpedoes were pretty unreliable. They tended to run round in circles. And in those days, people hadn't thought out deliberately sending torpedoes round in circles as they seem to do sometimes now. But no one was willing to give her really more reliable alternative torpedoes in case she was going to defect again. So one found oneself confronted with this opportunity in a vessel that was regarded as a rather bad security risk, but that we decided we could work very happily with. But there were rather odd features about it. I mean, one could see quite clearly where Pétain's and Darlan's pictures had been hanging in the wardroom, and they'd been taken down, and the screw marks are all still there. And the first lieutenant on board was a man called Billy. Had been in a rather senior police position in Marseille before joining the Navy again, and was not very well looked upon by some of our Gaullist friends. But L'Herminier was as brave as a lion, and in fact our decision to work with him proved highly satisfactory. And we were at the time very restricted in resources for supplying arms to Corsica. There were four aircraft only available in North Africa. It was too far away to be served by bases in England. And the topography of Corsica was far from ideal for parachute reception. That's to say that it's either very mountainous or it's very, very flat coastal plain. And the very, very flat coastal plain was heavily garrisoned, and so it was rarely possible to find a landing zone that could be used there, whereas the mountains were really too up and down to make dropping sticks of containers at all easy. And we lost quite a quantity of portion of what was dropped in through overshooting the mark or undershooting the mark and falling into chasms and outside the intended dropping zone, particularly as the aircraft frequently couldn't get as low as they wanted because of the mountains. So supply by sea was an urgently required alternative to this. And I set to work with the Casabianca, and we worked out an operation to carry 20 tons of armaments in the Casabianca to the one point on the coast that we thought we could work at night fairly undisturbed. And the problem was essentially that Corsica, that amounts to one département in French administrative terms, had got 80,000 Italian troops in it, and if they'd all stood around the beach at night, there would have been a man at almost in sight of his neighbour all the way round anyway, and getting ashore would have been very difficult. But it was heavily guarded all the way around the coast, but there was one point on the north coast which the Italians didn't care to have troops in at night because it was very malarial. And this was a point, an area known as the Désert des Agriates, which is between Saint-Florent and Calvi, both places which played an important part in Nelson's campaign in Corsica in 1793, Saint-Florent being the base he used for his ships. The original Martello Tower being a Genoese blockhouse on Mortella Point, which he had plans made from, and which was the prototype of the Martello Towers built round the British coast subsequently. And, of course, Calvi was where he lost his eye after having guns from the fleet landed and hauled up the mountains to a position where they dominated Calvi. Well, this was the bit of coast where I decided to operate, and I don't think any submarine operation in the Second World War, gun running, attempted to put anything like that cargo, volume of cargo ashore. At least I've never heard of it. But the method we worked out was to equip ourselves with aircraft as he rescued dinghies of a type that could carry 8 men, and we modified them, putting bottom boards, movable bottom boards into them, so that they could easily carry 0.5 ton of material. And fortunately, we'd got some of the little dories that I'd built in Percy Mitchell's yard at Mevagissey before we left Helford. And on arrival out in the Mediterranean, we'd modified these for submarine use by putting large screw bungs in the bottom of them so that when the submarine submerged, if they were lashed on top of the pressure hull, they could fill with water, and when the submarine surfaced again, they would drain. And you only had got to screw the plug back in again to make them perfectly watertight and usable in their normal purposes. So, with one dory towing two rubber boats, we thought we could land a ton at a time and keep doing this until we got through our cargo. Well, I went with enough of a crew to man the boats, and with radio sets to keep contact between each boat and the submarine. And L'Herminier surfaced off the Désert des Agriates. This must have been in late June or early July, probably, 1943. And I shall never forget the aromatic smell, this very calm night that assailed us. It was the maki, this highly aromatic herb undergrowth that covers the mountains. And baked in the sun all day, gives off a most pungent odor. And that type of smell travels marvelously over the water, so that I suppose we were perhaps between 0.5 mile and 1 mile offshore initially. One could smell it very, very strongly. But L'Herminier proceeded right inshore, having put the submarine into deep trim, until the bow of the submarine touched the beach and held her fast. He, of course, could bring her off by blowing his ballast tanks empty and reversing. But no British or American submarine would have ever been hazarded in that way by the captain. And, of course, it meant that we got, instead of having, well, 0.5 mile or perhaps even 1 mile to row ashore, we were left with a couple of hundred yards at most. And we worked throughout the first night and got most of the crew, most of the stuff ashore. And we had to go off and lie on the bottom during the day. But we went back in the second night and offloaded the rest, and the reception party was there, arranged by Colonna d'Istria. And we, in due course, returned to base. However, a month later, I had to do another operation with the Casabianca to fetch out Colonna d'Istria from a beach on the east coast. And to fetch him out with a local a communist leader. And we embarked them perfectly successfully. But in the course of this operation, I had just gone down with malaria, which I undoubtedly had contracted in spite of my anti-malaria pills, in the course of this operation, the gun-running operation in the Désert des Agriates. And I had nearly 21 days at sea with this recurrent fever, and nowhere I could be laid up, or there was no sick quarters on a submarine, obviously. So really it wasn't even possible to stay in bed. And by the time I got back to Algiers, I was rather debilitated and clapped into hospital, where they dosed me heavily and then told me I'd better go home to England to convalesce. So I was flown home and spent 2 or 3 weeks at home before being flown out again to Algiers. And on arrival in Algiers, the situation had changed substantially. First of all, in Italy, the King and Badoglio had arrested Mussolini and had opened, or had made a first tentative approach in Lisbon to the Allies to say they wanted to conduct an armistice. And then came the question of exactly on what channel was this armistice to be negotiated. Well, just before then, Massingham had parachuted into Italy a radio operator called Mallory, Chris Mallory, not the man who had been in jail in Tunis and who was still a prisoner in German hands, been taken off to Germany. But Chris Mallory had been dropped blind into one of the North Italian lakes. I can't remember if it was Como or Garda, but he'd been picked up by the Italian police immediately and thrown into jail. And somebody in SOE, I suspect it may have been Douglas Dodds Parker, who was then in charge of Massingham, said, "Right, look, here's the opportunity both to save Chris Mallory and to conduct the negotiation on a secure link. We must tell Badoglio and the King that the only acceptable channel of communication for this negotiation will be on Chris Mallory's radio set, operated by him using his ciphers, and that as we know his operating style, we shall immediately detect it if there's any double crossing." So Mallory found himself moved out of jail, installed comfortably somewhere convenient, can't remember where it was, probably up in the north, and conducting the whole of the negotiation for the Italian armistice. And at the Algiers end, this all had to be deciphered manually, and there were four Fanny, first aid, nursing, yeomanry ensigns who were allocated to this job and were shut up in a villa on security grounds, not allowed to talk to anybody. And as telex lines weren't available, each telegram had to be ferried by a dispatch rider into Eisenhower in Algiers. And right in the middle of this key negotiation, I shall never forget